Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 631, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2008. Well, we were talking about the political fall of Eliot Spitzer partying like it was 1929. In the meantime, it's business as usual for the Republicans. We're going to hop right in by taking a look at Neil Bush. By the way, Neil Bush was deeply connected to many of the ripoffs of savings and loan institutions in the late 80s. Of course, nothing ever happened to him for Silverado Savings and Loan or for the Sunflow case, and it's business as usual for Neil Bush. This is an AP story by Pedro Servine. It's datelined Asuncion, Paraguay, and it reads, Bush's younger brother visits Paraguay. But it's who was his sponsor in Paraguay that's interesting here. The article reads, Neil Bush, younger brother of U.S. President George W. Bush, called on Paraguay's president as the guest of a business federation founded by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. A presidential press office source who spoke on condition of not being named confirmed the younger Bush met President Nicanor Duarte on Thursday along with a delegation from the Universal Peace Federation, a group associated with Moon. Duarte himself had no statement on the meeting. Antonio Betancourt, a spokesman for the Red Federation, said that Bush visited Duarte and later met with an opposition congressional leader, Senator Miguel Abdon Saguier, and that both expressed interest in the Bush family and discussed local matters. Betancourt said Bush later attended a leadership seminar sponsored by the Moon Federation. The Federation's website says it is trying to promote peace in the Middle East, South Asia, and other regions, as well as proposing a 50-mile, $200 billion tunnel linking Siberia and Alaska. A leading Paraguayan newspaper, ABC Color, reported Friday that Bush spoke at the leadership seminar about installing a culture of service, unquote, and better uniting individuals and organizations behind objectives that serve peace and the common good. It said the seminar held at an Asuncion hotel was titled Towards a New Paradigm of Leadership and Government in Times of World Crisis, unquote. The newspaper said other participants included José María Sanguinetti, the former Uruguayan president. Groups allied with Reverend Moon publish a newspaper, operate businesses, and have large landholdings in Paraguay, South America's second poorest country. And as discussed in, among other programs, AFA7 and a program you can access online, For the Record Program 291, the evidence is very strong that, in fact, the Moon Organization is an extension of the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies and a projection of them through the decades and around the world. It was the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies that brought fascism to Japan through a wave of political assassinations and political agitprop, the Bush family has been deeply involved with the Moon Organization. Again, I emphatically recommend listeners both use the description for and listen to the actual broadcast of For the Record 291 titled From Kennebunkport to Pearl Harbor, Bush, Moon, and the Rising Sun. And speaking of rising suns, it looks like the rising sun of George Bush, namely Neil Bush, is in fact consorting with the rising sun in the form of the Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies, in this case, the Moon Organization. There was an interesting case that emerged earlier this month. One of the things that has never been really, well, it really hasn't been pursued at all, but that concerns the anthrax attacks back in 2001. Remember them? We haven't heard too much about those, have we? One of the places where the trail led to and then went cold was in the vicinity of Las Vegas, specifically a Las Vegas suburb called Henderson, Nevada. I refer listeners to, among other broadcasts, For the Record 419, looking back on the anthrax attacks. There has been another apparent example of, if not biological terrorism, certainly the utilization of an agent that could be used for biological terrorism. And it was a very interesting case that raises more questions than it answers. The following story is, again, it's an AP story. It was date copyrighted 2008, and I'll get you the exact date for this on the description for the program. Suburban Utah Home Searched for Ricin. It's by Doug Alden of the AP, and it reads, FBI agents wearing protective suits searched Sunday for the deadly poison ricin at a suburban home where a man possibly sickened by the deadly poison had once lived. Authorities believe they had found all of the ricin in several vials recovered Thursday from a Las Vegas motel where Roger von Bergendorf had been staying, but they also wanted to check out the home in Riverton outside Salt Lake City. "We're taking all the precautions necessary to ensure public safety," FBI agent Timothy Furman said at a news conference Sunday. Nearby homes were evacuated as FBI agents covered from head to toe in full hazardous material protection suits meticulously searched the home belonging to von Bergendorf's cousin Thomas Tholen, T-H-O-L-E-N. Von Bergendorf had been staying in the motel room where the ricin was found and has been hospitalized since February 14th. Von Bergendorf has been unconscious, so police and the FBI have not been able to question him on the ricin found in his room. Health officials are still trying to confirm whether von Bergendorf's respiratory ailment stemmed from ricin exposure. Not mentioned here, and actually mentioned a little bit further down, Las Vegas police said that firearms, an anarchist-type textbook, unquote, and castor beans from which ricin is made were found in the room where the poison was discovered. The book was tabbed at a spot containing information about ricin. Furman said investigators are still trying to figure out why von Bergendorf would have ricin, but said there was no indication of any terrorist activity. Well, a lot of this is a case that raises more questions than it answers. First of all, how can they say there was no indication of terrorist activity? How many people go around developing a deadly biotoxin? I mean, it isn't the sort of thing you do for the Kiwanis Club, okay? I would also note that he had guns, an anarchist-type cookbook, unquote, and was making ricin. Why do you make ricin? Also, I would note the guy's name, von Bergendorf. Now, that too, like Dietrich Snell, that's a nice Anglo-Saxon name. The prefix von is indicative of the German aristocracy. By the way, recent reports have dropped the von. They just call him Roger Bergendorf. One of the people who was trucking around anthrax was an American Nazi named Larry Harris, who alleged that he worked for the CIA, whether or not he did. He also got popped in, among other places, Henderson, Nevada, and it turned out that he had a business partner who had a medical laboratory in Germany, of all places. So who is Roger von Bergendorf? Why have they dropped the von? What is going on here? Again, this is a very interesting case, a very mysterious case, and one that raises more questions than it answers. But again, I also, in this context, and I'm not necessarily saying that's the case, but where did the children of the SS go? One of the people, the main author, by the way, of the national intelligence estimate that said that Iran was no longer developing nuclear weapons was a guy named von von Diepen. Who is he? What did his father do in World War II? Again, questions to which I do not have the answer. One of the reasons I bring these questions up is that in a broadcast in which we dealt with a Hamas front organization, we took a look at the fact that the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints was helping to finance this Hamas front organization, thereby helping to finance Islamic terrorism and Islamic fascism. This is not to say that Mormons are terrorists or treasonous, far from it, but it does raise some interesting questions. And the person who was the head of that particular Hamas front that was receiving money from the Mormons was the son of Cherem Subzikov, an SS officer who was brought into the United States at the end of World War II to serve in the U.S. intelligence apparatus. He also had worked with some of the Muslim Waffen SS formations, such as the Caucasian Legion that were put together by the Grand Mufti and others in World War II. So there's at least one example of an SS son, so to speak, working in a similar capacity to that in which the father had worked. So, again, I wonder about Roger von Bergendorf. Who was he? Why have they dropped the von part? And speaking of Germans and what did your daddy do in World War II, a new elder in the Mormon Church is of German extraction, and his curriculum vitae is an interesting one. This is a fellow named Dieter Uchtdorf, and the following story is a Yahoo story that in turn is from Deutsche Welle, the German news service. This article is called "German Joins Innermost Mormon Circle," and it reads, in part, "Following the recent death of the Mormon spiritual leader, a German pilot has joined the highest leadership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by becoming one of two counselors to the new Mormon head. Dieter Uchtdorf's appearance doesn't immediately hint at anything unusual. This 64-year-old, who worked as chief pilot for Germany's Lufthansa airline, dresses conservatively but smartly. His countenance is one of open acceptance. He could be of any ex-professional retiree, but Uchtdorf is something a little out of the ordinary. He is Germany's first member of the Mormon so-called First Presidency, which is made up of a president, a prophet, and two counselors. According to the beliefs of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS, the official title of the Mormons, God chooses apostles to lead the church in modern times as he did in times of the Bible. Skipping down about his background, Uchtdorf's rise to the upper echelons of the LDS Church is one marked by great upheaval in his life. He was twice a refugee as a child, first as an expellee from the former Czechoslovakia at the end of World War II, and again in 1951 when his family had to flee East Germany because of his father's political leanings. Now, certainly there were plenty of people who ran afoul of the East German government, or the government of the former East Germany, which was pretty ripe in many ways. What I find most interesting about this, though, is the fact that his family had to flee from Czechoslovakia. It was the Sudeten Germans and the German minority inside of Czechoslovakia that were the rationale for the Nazi annexation, first of the Sudetenland and later all of Czechoslovakia. This was basically sort of a manifestation of the Volksgruppenrechte that we've spoken about in the past, or the going native policy. And at the end of World War II, Germans, and in particular those who had collaborated with the Nazis, were expelled wholesale from Czechoslovakia. And now, of course, there is no more Czechoslovakia. There's the Czech Republic, and Slovakia has become a, quote, independent country, as it did under German occupation, where they temporarily split the Czechoslovaks and the Slovakians, the Czechs and the Slovaks. So, again, I'm not saying this is necessarily sinister, but it is interesting in light of the existence of the Underground Reich and its manifestation as a classic example of what I call the virtual state. That is a very, very important concept. It's a state without formal geographical borders, and one in which that exists in a number of different places. Some of the books about some of the anti-fascist books available on the Spitfire website go into this. In terms of the agitation of the German minority in Czechoslovakia, the book Armies of Spies goes into that. And in terms of the plans to scatter throughout the world and maintain an underground Reich, the book The Nazis Go Underground from early 1944 goes into that, and then couple that with the classic Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning, and you'll have a blueprint for what leads me to ask these kinds of questions. Who is Dieter Uchtdorf? An article, a couple of articles really that are, I guess, are a tribute to not only the moral and philosophical bankruptcy of the so-called progressive political sector. It's one of the things that enables the Republicans to just keep doing what they do. And it also is indicative of the extent to which the so-called progressive political sector has become something of a fifth column on behalf of the Islamic fascists. And it also exemplifies why I refer to it as the progressive political sector. The following article is also an AP story from February 13th of 2008, Cindy Sheehan in Egypt for the Islamists. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan joined a protest Wednesday seeking the support of Egypt's First Lady in ending a military trial of members of the country's largest Islamic organization. Under the watchful eyes of dozens of black-clad and helmeted anti-riot police, some 50 heavily veiled wives and children of 40 senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood detained for the past year gathered in front of the headquarters of the First Lady Suzanne Mubarak's National Council of Women, carrying banners calling for their release. "I am here to protest the trial of civilians in front of a military tribunal, as this is a violation to international law," unquote, said Sheehan, who gained fame for in the U.S. for her sit-in opposite President Bush, Texas ranch following the death of her son in Iraq. "As a mother of a son who was killed in the war, I presented a letter to Ms. Suzanne Mubarak to realize how those women and children are suffering." The Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, is not only an Islamic fascist organization, but it's one that believes that the entire world should be governed by the most reactionary interpretations of Muslim law, Sharia. The very interests on whose behalf Cindy Sheehan is marching here, and later, as we'll see, speaking on Al Jazeera, when they achieved some significant parliamentary success in the early part of this decade, they began launching a campaign. And this is by no means the most murderous or bloody of the things that they have advocated, but they began launching a campaign to have sanitary napkin dispensers banned from high schools, public high schools, banned from the women's rooms in public high schools. This would, of course, have made it extremely difficult for menstruating women to attend high school. Under strict Islamic law, menstruating women are considered deeply unclean, and men are not to have contact with them. Now, I wonder what Cindy Sheehan would think about that. Certainly, she hasn't been talking about that on Al Jazeera. She has been talking on Al Jazeera. The following also is, this is by Liam Stack in Cairo. It's from the Yahoo News Service. Cindy Sheehan is in Cairo to protest the Egyptian government's decision to try members of the Muslim Brotherhood in a military court. And it goes on to discuss the fact, and I will have an annotation for this, but she has been speaking on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood on Al Jazeera. Noted here a little bit of the interview. Al Jazeera, you first became famous for your protests against the Iraq War in August of 2005, but you have not been an active anti-war figure for a while now. What happened? And then Cindy Sheehan goes on, and she hasn't been real active in the U.S., but here she is in Egypt, mobilizing on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, isn't that special? I wonder who Cindy Sheehan voted for in the 2000 election. She's from Berkeley. I wonder if she voted for Darth Nader. Who knows? But in any event, it just, that's, people wonder, maybe they, people think I'm a bit of a curmudgeon. I am actually a bit of a curmudgeon, more than a bit perhaps, but when I talk about the so-called progressive political sector, that's the sort of BS I'm talking about. Something that maybe has hopefully has caught veteran listeners' attention, and that is the turmoil currently embracing China, courtesy of Tibet, as China gets ready to host the 2008 Summer Olympics. In a number of programs, for the record, programs 547, 548, 549, and 550, we took a look at the virtual state, the underground Reich, and we specifically took a look at how the Dalai Lama and also Uyghur Muslims are being utilized as vehicles for covert action to destabilize China and also other large countries. In particular, Mongolians, Uyghur Muslims, and Tibetans have been utilized to help fragment China. In For the Record, program 547, we took a look at the Dalai Lama's close association with SS officers and their incorporation into the milieu of the Tibetan government in exile. They're not actually officials of the Tibetan government in exile, but they work with it. And we also, in For the Record programs 615 and 616, took a look at German support for the Dalai Lama and how the secession of Tibet has been compared to and also assisted by the South Tyrolean nationalist movement, and a movement that aims at achieving autonomy for the Germanic minorities in the northern part of Italy, the South Tyrol. One of the institutions that we've looked at considerable length in conjunction with the destabilization of China and other large countries, and that is the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. Now, that sounds like just a wonderful old organization. Certainly, no one believes more in human rights than I do, and I certainly don't want to see anybody get their rights trampled. On the other hand, what the UNPO does, it's a manifestation of Volksgruppen Rechte, or as I call it, going native. They champion the rights of small, often genuinely impressed indigenous peoples, but not as a democratic slash egalitarian principle, but in order to use those as vehicles for the fragmentation and ultimate destabilization and subjugation of rival states, in particular larger rival states. In For the Record 627, we looked at the application of Volksgruppen Rechte, or going native, to Kosovo of the former Yugoslavia. And we also have been looking at the going native manifestation in other respects as well. The Dalai Lama, by the way, has been in bed with the Third Reich since he was a little boy, since he was a little llama back in the 1940s. And he's also worked very closely with the CIA, among other institutions. He is one of the central elements of the UNPO and also champions pan-Turkist Uyghur separation as well. Again, For the records, 547, 8, 9, 550. For the records, 615 and 616 go into that. And note the following. This is a press release slash polemic that was released by the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. By the way, that Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization is headed up by none other than Karl von Habsburg, the heir to the throne of Habsburg of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His father was not only one of the far right-wing members of the European Parliament, but also a member of the Free Rudolf Hess Society or Association. Rudolf Hess was one of Hitler's deputies and the last prisoner from the Nuremberg trials. And the elder von Habsburg was a member of that organization. His son, Karl von Habsburg, is married to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza of the Thyssen-Bornemisza's, the Thyssen-Bornemisza Industrial Empire and the Thyssen interests in general, one of the fundamental pivot points of and one of the principal elements in the Underground Reich and the Bormann Capital Network in particular. The Thyssens have been longtime supporters of fascism in both the Third Reich period and its post-war Underground Reich manifestation. And the Thyssen's main business contact in the U.S., a fellow named George Herbert Walker and his son, Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather of the current seated president of the United States. And so note that this organization that's advocating the rights of native peoples is headed up by the heir to one of the great imperial houses of Europe, namely the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the UNPO of Karl von Habsburg, married to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, has issued the following on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th of 2008. China, stop slaughtering Tibet, so says Karl von Habsburg, married to the Thyssen-Bornemisza's. Following events that have struck at the heart of Tibet, the UNPO presidency, on behalf of UNPO members, expresses its full support for all those under threat from the crackdown currently being carried out by the security agencies of the Chinese state under the blanket of a media blackout. The Hague, March 17, 2008. The UNPO presidency, led by Mr. Le Dume Mite, expresses its solidarity on behalf of all UNPO members with the people of Tibet in this period of extreme tension and reiterates its support for their decades-long nonviolent campaign against Chinese suppression. And again, this is coming from the heir to the throne of the Habsburgs. And also note the following, and this sort of conceptualizes China in the viewpoint of those who would like to see it broken up. This is also not in any way to hold a brief for the most reactionary elements of Chinese society. Certainly they are very reactionary indeed. There certainly are some indications of creeping liberalism, and it is creeping very slowly in China. But it certainly remains a place where I certainly wouldn't want to be a political dissident, and I don't think anybody else would either. Nonetheless, the activities like this are probably actually intended to produce crackdowns and ultimately the destabilization of China itself. This article is from the online magazine Slate. It's authored by Ann Applebaum, who, among other things, is a columnist for The Washington Post, one of America's newspapers of record and also an institution that maintains close ties with the Central Intelligence Agency. Ann Applebaum has written in her column Live from Lhasa, "Cell phone photographs and videos from Tibet, blurry and amateur, are circulating on the Internet. Some show clouds of tear gas, others burning buildings and shops, still others purple-robed monks, riot police in confusion. Watching them, it is impossible not to remember the cell phone videos and photographs sent out from burning Rangoon only 6 months ago. Last year Burma, this year Tibet, next year will YouTube feature shops burning in Xinjiang, the home of China's Uyghur minority? Or riot police rounding up refugees along the Chinese-North Korean border? P.S. It was the Uyghurs, who are ethnic Muslims and have a Turkic language, who have been the focal points not only of UNPO activism. They're allied with the Dalai Lama. They also have strong links to the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamo-fascists and Al-Qaeda. And skipping down, as in this particular story, but then, as modern China bears many surprising resemblances to the empires of the past in other ways, too, Like its Soviet imperial predecessor, for example, China encompasses both an inner empire, of which Tibet and Xinjiang are the most prominent components, and an outer empire consisting most notably of its Burmese and North Korean clients. Like its French and British predecessors, the Chinese Empire must wrestle constantly with nations whose languages, religions, and customs differ sharply from its own, and whose behavior is, therefore, unpredictable. And like all its predecessors, the Chinese imperial class cares deeply about the pacification of the imperial periphery, more so than one might think. And so, again, that Chinese Empire, boy, that's terrible. And let's hope that the UNPO is able to champion that, because they're not into empire, are they? Who would ever suspect the Habsburgs of championing empire? Not me. And in For the Record 630, we took a look at well, the cost of partying like it's 1929. I have noted in the past that among the oppressed peoples, and these are peoples with genuine grievances, I don't want to be misunderstood there, but they are also championing the rights of native peoples in the U.S., such as the Hawaiians, and Japan has long coveted Hawaii, and also the Lakota Indians. And just to get a bankrupt United States, particularly one that is disrupted by terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction, a la Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk. And one could very easily perhaps see, if not the secession of these groups, a bloody neo-Palestinian situation in the U.S. with the Lakota and perhaps other native peoples being viewed by the rest of the world as sort of America's Palestinians. In this regard, I would note the following. A number of different news media have reported this, but the Lakota have formally withdrawn from their treaties that they signed with the United States. And this is from news.com from December 20th of 2007. This article reads, Lakota Indians withdraw treaties signed with the U.S. 150 years ago, and the Lakota are one of the groups championed by the UNPO. The Lakota Indians, who gave the world legendary warriors Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, have withdrawn from treaties with the United States. We are no longer citizens of the United States of America, and all those who live in the five-state area that encompasses our country are free to join us, unquote, longtime Indian rights activist Russell Means said. A delegation of Lakota leaders has delivered a message to the State Department and said they were unilaterally withdrawing from treaties they signed with the federal government of the U.S., some of them more than 150 years old. The group also visited the Bolivian, Chilean, South African, and Venezuelan embassies and would continue on their diplomatic mission and take it overseas in the coming weeks and months. Lakota country includes parts of the states of Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming. The new country would issue its own passports and driving licenses, and living there would be tax-free, provided residents renounce their U.S. citizenship, Mr. Means said. That could be a very wonderful little offshore area, as Lucy Commissar has put it, but do note that the UNPO is championing these groups, too, and as I've noted in the past, vis-a-vis the Lakota, they have very real grievances. Lakota have been thoroughly screwed. I want to note that for the purposes of Native Americans and also those active on behalf of Native American rights, and there are people who listen to these broadcasts in both categories, the very real grievances against the U.S. on behalf of the Lakota notwithstanding, grievances which will hopefully be corrected. I wouldn't hold my breath. But people want to be very careful because the people that the Lakota are working for, the UNPO, the Habsburgs, and their like, these are the white men that the white man who screwed you came over here to escape from. Forgive me for ending a sentence with a preposition. They won't be partying like it's 1929. They'll be partying like it's 1829. That was some party, wasn't it? This concludes For the Record program number 631, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This has been recorded on March 23rd of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.